Hi there, I'm Alistair Madden, and you're listening to Season 3, Episode 19 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. If you haven't already done so, please do consider subscribing to the podcast. Doing so would really help us to grow the podcast even more. We, of course, release an episode every fortnight, so every second Friday, early in the morning, we put out a new episode covering all the latest goings-on across European football. In terms of this particular episode, I would, of course, direct you to the show notes, where you will find a comprehensive running order of the topics we covered and the questions we answered. I will, however, give you the usual brief overview. In Italy, we considered the role to be played by Napoli's fringe players, and we asked ourselves whether this might be a last dance of sorts for the current squad. In France, we discussed my recent visit to the Stade de la Meinau. I was there to see Strasbourg take on Lens, so we unpacked that game and looked at where it was ultimately won and lost. Elsewhere in Spain, we put Sevilla under the Road to Nowhere microscope, analysing some of the factors behind their recent drop-off in form, while in Germany we looked at the significance of Hertha Berlin's decision to appoint Felix Magath as their new manager. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual detailed way. This episode is, of course, produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops' subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the episode. Hopefully you're all staying safe. Hopefully you're all staying well. Thanks, as always, for your continued support. Enjoy. I'm joining this episode from the living room of a lovely top four flat in Strasbourg. Michael Jones is with me virtually, and over the course of the episode, we'll dial in the increasingly coveted Rory Barlow. Michael Jones, how are things with you?
Yeah, good, thank you. I'm joining from a top floor flat in a much gloomier Manchester. So I'm very jealous, of course, the place where we met. What a city.
Of course. We were just reminiscing on one of the pitches on which we used to play. And we were saying we're not quite sure how no one suffered a serious injury, although Michael did suggest that his ACL woes were perhaps put in motion by playing on that bobbly pitch at the university campus in Strasbourg. Just looking at it again, it was a treacherous surface anyway. Michael Jones, other than your ongoing ACL woes, your things are good with you, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. What about yourself, Ali?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I'm still on cloud nine from my return to the Stade de la Meinau on Sunday to take in Strasbourg's huge Ligue 1 clash with Lens. And I think, Michael, that fixture probably represents the best place for us to start this episode.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously from seeing in our group chat, let alone everywhere else, Strasbourg won the game 1-0. That result lifted Julian Stefan's side into fourth place and kept alive their hopes of securing European football next season. Firstly, what was it like being back at the Meinau for the first time since before the COVID pandemic? And secondly, where was the game ultimately won and lost in your eyes?
Yeah, it was lovely to be back, Michael. It was a nice trip down memory lane. I went for my merguez sandwich before the game with my friend who I used to sit next to when I had my season ticket at Strasbourg. And it was all very nostalgic. It was great being back inside the stadium. It was great seeing the ultras behind the goal. It was great hearing the iconic stadium announcer. His dulcet tones are, yeah, unforgettable, to put it one way. And it was so nice to be back, Michael. We're obviously still here. We're heading to Paris again tomorrow, but it's one of my favourite cities in the world. the food here is amazing. The people here are really friendly, so long as you at least attempt to speak French, although thankfully in my case, as you know, Michael, I can speak French quite well, and the football itself, absolutely wonderful. So yeah, so good to be back. It felt at one point during the COVID pandemic like it would be quite some time before we would be able to go to games on the continent, before we'd be able to go to a Strasbourg game. And so to be able to get back, even though it has taken, you know, 3 years, I think, now since I was last at the Maino. I was there for the game against Nice in about the same time in 2019. So it's fantastic to be back and to be part of what has been a magical season. And that will take me on quite nicely to the second question you've put to me. Where was this game won and lost? A lot of the chat before the game in and around the stadium, it was dominated by the fact that both Sanjin Pirtic and Adrian Thomasson would be absent for Strasbourg. Those two players are so crucial to what Strasbourg do. Pirtic, who of course regularly gets called up by Bosnia and Herzegovina to represent his national team, he is the player who dictates the tempo of Strasbourg's play. He is arguably the player with the greatest decision-making in that team. And he's a player who is able to put his foot in the ball in the middle of the park and either slow the play down or speed the play up, spread the play or go narrow. He always seems to make the right decision. And so without him in the team, you lose a lot of those really important attributes. Adrian Thomasson, as I've said on multiple occasions, is what you would describe in technical terms as a nuisance. He is one of the preciest players in French football. I think he's in, yeah, certainly in the top four or five players for pressure applied, and he's in the 99th percentile for a lot of the key pressure applying statistics. So to miss those two players obviously has a huge impact on your style of play. You're having to bring in reserve players. When we consider as well the opposition on Sunday, Lens, one of their best players is Seko Fofana in the middle of the park. One of the best players in the league, Seko Fofana. It was actually a joy to watch him play in person. I'll come on to his performance shortly. But yeah, I think a lot of the chat before the game was dominated by the fact that both Pirtic and Thomasson would be absent. And yeah, there were a lot of fears perhaps that would maybe tip the game in Lens's favour. The two teams are obviously quite evenly matched and only a few points separated them going into this game. And I think a lot of people thought in a game of such fine margins, the absence of Pirtic and Thomasson would be quite significant. However, fair play to Ibrahima Sissoko, Jean-Rigner Bellegarde and Jean-Oud Ahoulo, who formed that midfield three. Strasbourg were playing their usual 3-5-2 with Frédéric Gilbert, of course, spent time at Aston Villa down the right-hand side, and club legend Dimitri Leonard, who's been there since the promotion season 2016-2017. I think he's the only player left from that campaign. He's the captain and he was excellent down the left-hand side. So it was a battle of the wing-backs. Strasbourg had their wing-backs in a 3-5-2, and Lens, of course, had their two wing-backs in their 3-5-2. You had Frankowski, the Polish wing-back, on the left, and then you had the recently capped Jonathan Klaus back from international duty, back from that fairy tale international duty down the right-hand side. And so obviously in the middle of the park, there would be quite a lot of interest there, but you did feel like it was going to be a battle of the wing-backs, and a battle of the wing-backs it turned out to be, quite remarkably, at least on Jonathan Klaus's side. It was Dimitri Leonard who prevailed, probably one of Jonathan Klaus's quietest games in a Lens shirt for quite some time. And I think that's testimony to just how impressive Leonard was. He's a threat from set pieces, but defensively as well, he's shown himself to be increasingly capable. So that was one of the main reasons I think Strasbourg won this game, because Leonard was able to nullify almost totally the threat of Jonathan Klaus. And on the other side, Frédéric Gilbert offered more going forward. He had a huge chance in the first half, nicked in and dispossessed. I think it was Facundo Medina who wasn't concentrating. I think nobody in the stadium was concentrating. We'd almost turned away and then turned back and realised that Gilbert was through one-on-one. And then Jean-Louis Leca, who I'd spent the full first half explaining to my dad, he wasn't the best of goalkeepers, and I think most people would agree with me, but he pulled off an impressive save to deny Gilbert. And then in the second half, we saw Gilbert getting forward again, and he missed a huge chance at 1-0 Strasbourg to make it 2-0. Back post header, lovely cross from Ibrahima Sissoko, and he managed to contrive to put it over the bar. But overall, yeah, the two wing-backs for Strasbourg outclassed their opposite numbers for Lens.
in the middle of the park. I said I would come on to Seko Fofana. Ibrahima Sissoko just about outclassed him in the second half. He was quite lethargic in the first half, was dispossessed a few times, lost possession in dangerous areas, Sissoko, but came out in the second half. And as he does, his performances do go up and down. He's quite an inconsistent player, frustratingly inconsistent, because when he's on his game, he's one of the best midfielders, being linked with Roma, I'm pretty sure, as well. When he's on his game, he's so influential. And in the second half, he stepped up a couple of levels and played as we know he can play, and was really quite integral to Strasbourg's victory. But Seko Fofana, Michael, we've waxed lyrical about him on the podcast before, and to see him play in person, you do really appreciate just how strong he is, just how good his decision-making is. He almost always seemed to pick the right pass, or one or two times when he looked a little bit lethargic, a little bit off the pace. But generally speaking, over the course of the 90 minutes, every time he got the ball, he seemed to drive forward when he should be driving forward. He seemed to spread the play when he should be spreading the play. He seemed to thread passes through when that through ball was on. Every decision he made, or almost every decision he made, was perfect. He did get a little bit nervous whenever he picked up the ball. And he picked up the ball, I think, a minute or two into stoppage time. And you could see him as if he was going to line up the shot. And you thought, please don't shoot, because he'd gone close two or three times already. And he didn't. He picked a pass. And it was a sensible pass at that, and almost led to an opening for Lens. But yeah, he's the sort of player who you can easily see why he's been linked with the likes of Newcastle. And after the game, I was catching back up with my friend from who used to sit next to me at the season ticket. And he was saying Sissoko was better in the second half, but if you could swap Sissoko for Fofana, probably Strasbourg go on and win that game 2-3-0. And that's not a slight on Ibrahima Sissoko, far from it. It's just to praise the wonderful Seko Fofana. And I think he's destined for greater things even than Lens. Overall, I think Strasbourg thoroughly deserved the win. They obviously scored one of their two penalties. Ludovic Ajorc converted, and then moments later, Ajorc wins a penalty, which Kevin Gamero blasts almost straight at Jean-Louis Leca. Could have made the game a lot more comfortable, but in the end, still, Strasbourg defensively are so solid. I think you have to give a lot of credit to that back three, Alexander Djiku, Jairzinho Niamsi, and Anthony Katsi. I thought they were excellent at, well, defensively first and foremost, but also when Strasbourg were in possession, at dropping into the right areas, taking the ball on and then spreading the play, recycling possession. There was always an option to use that back three. And it wasn't too conservative an option at once if Strasbourg were being too defensive when they were passing it back. It was just being sensible, and they would start attacks again. They would go down the other side. They would pull Lens in, they'd pull them out. And they got a lot of joy, particularly in the second half when Lens started to tire, from moving the ball across that back three and then playing either a diagonal pass forward or playing it into the likes of Jean-Rietner Bellegarde or Sissoko, who would drop a little bit deeper and then he would interchange with Kevin Gamero and get in behind that Lens back line. It was an excellent performance from Strasbourg, a lot more technical, a lot more nuanced than some of the performances I would have seen when they were in Ligue 2 under Thierry Lallier, and a lot more convincing than the performances I'd seen when I'd gone to see them in Ligue 1 as well. So all in all, an excellent afternoon, Michael. We went to the Dubliner for a pint afterwards, and some of the Strasbourg ultras were also in there singing some of their songs. Yeah, they seem to be enjoying their season. It's great to see Strasbourg doing as well as they're doing, and doing so in front of a full crowd. The full stadium was bouncing, as opposed to on occasion in Ligue 2, it was just the ultras behind the goals who were really contributing to the atmosphere. On Sunday, it was the full ground, the Tifo displays, the Lens fans in the away section, everything contributed to a great atmosphere. It went almost as well as it could possibly have gone, Michael. Okay, we are going to wrap up our analysis of Strasbourg's huge win over Lens there. We're going to dial in Rudy Barlow. We're going to perform our scheduling gymnastics as we've tended to do in recent episodes. We're going to get the lowdown on all the latest things from La Liga. We'll be right back.
In Spain against Barcelona, Sevilla fell to defeat at Camp Nou with this past weekend, making it just two wins in their last seven matches. It feels as if they have hit the wall as a squad, and from being Real Madrid's closest title challengers, they now sit fourth. Where has it gone wrong for Sevilla in the last 2 months, and what's changed given you were praising them for their ability to overcome adversity recently?
Yeah, well, firstly, I'll say that just due to sort of scheduling issues, and all my fault, I should say, we're without Ali Madden, and I feel like we've been let out, sort of like we're without supervision, we've been let out the box to play. So I'm sure the listeners will understand when everything goes wrong here. But yeah, thanks, Michael. It's Sevilla are an interesting one. I think they're a really hard case to assess this season. Partly, I think we should just say that this is a regression to the mean. They're sat in fourth place, as you say. They're now level on points with Sevilla and Atletico Madrid. If you'd said that at the start of the season, probably be fairly happy with that. And a big part of this kind of regression and the fact that they've been struggling for wins so much is their continuous injury problems. They've been hampered by injuries all season, and it's been a big issue. If we think about their target again at the start of the season, Champions League probably is what they were after. So on the face of it, it's maybe disappointing just given where they were. But yeah, okay, you can make an argument that there's no disappointment here. Having said that, I do think the club itself and the fans thought that there was a title race to be had here. They brought in Anthony Martial on loan from Manchester United, obviously. Brought in Tecatito Corona from Porto, who's been good as well in spells. And so I think both of those signings really pointed to the fact that Sevilla themselves thought they had a shot at this title. The fact that in their last, I mean, it's partly due to sort of the run of draws and the lack of wins, but in their last match against Real Sociedad at home, the fans booed them off the park, which, I mean, for a team that's kind of meeting expectations, there has to be something kind of going wrong for that to happen. So yeah, the two wins in the seven, if you take that, you turn sort of three of those draws into wins, and they're within 3 points of Real Madrid. So I do think that on one level or another, whether they want to admit it, whether they want to sort of accept that themselves, there was a tight race to be had for Sevilla. And part of all those factors that I've just mentioned make it so hard to measure them this season. Because they were the kind of closest title challengers for a long time. They really looked like they were the only team that were going to go the distance with Real Madrid. But they're also averaging less points per match this season. I think they don't look as good. They aren't as intimidating as they were. Perhaps they're better defensively. They're the best defense in the league. But one thing that really stood out to me the other day that Monchi said, the sporting director, he's kind of very famous in Spain, and I think his legend has maybe made it out of Spain a little bit as well. He's credited with being kind of the genius behind Sevilla's kind of seven Europa Leagues on the whole. One thing that he said to Radio Marca recently enough was that Sevilla have started looking for a different kind of player. They've changed their strategy and they're looking for more sort of well-rounded, more complete players, essentially, as part of their transfer strategy, which, although on the face of it, I understand. And I think it was meant to be a move into sort of making Sevilla part of the big four. And they're well on their way to doing that. But I do think there's perhaps a little bit of an error in there. I think maybe Sevilla, in one sense, have not quite sort of appreciated the value of having youth in their squad, of having sort of the competition that sort of a few younger players who are developing, who are making strides, can really add to a squad. I think especially if you look at Barcelona, they've kind of had their revolution in inverted commas. If you look at Real Madrid, Vinicius was the sort of big sort of factor that nobody was counting on Vinicius to be quite as good as he was in the first half of the season. And that's what made Real Madrid sort of runaway leaders for a long time. The fact that they prioritised Eric Lamela, Anthony Martial, Suso, again, these players have been injured a lot of the season, and that on one level unfortunate, instead of Brian Hill, who they sold to Tottenham instead. I look at Brian Hill in the Valencia team and I think, yeah, he would have contributed more to this team than Lamela or Suso. And the likes of bringing in sort of like Ludwig Augustinsson from Werder Bremen, which so far it's not kind of really worked out, to be honest. He's been in and out with injury. When he has played, he's been a bit of a liability so far, to be honest. You think, yeah, maybe you should have signed sort of a younger left back and given them the space to develop, because they've got Marcus Acuña. And if you have that sort of competition that the young player is kind of striving to provide, whereas Augustinsson, I think he's probably aware of his role. He's probably not going to beat out Marcos Acuña for his place. The average age of Sofia's squad is 28.12 years, which, aside from one season in the last decade, is the only time they've exceeded 26 on that kind of average age, which was 26.52. So by quite a distance, this is the oldest Sevilla side that they've had in years and years. And I think that's been a factor, because we look at those injuries and you look at their starting lineup. They've got Jesus Navas, who's 36, I believe now, Ivan Rakitic, Fernando. They've a lot of players that are really sort of aging into their 30s. And so if you play that style of play that we were talking about before, where it's so based on intensity, it's so based on having sort of a real attitude of pushing everything to the limit, of making sure that you're running that extra yard, making sure that everybody's defensively solid, you'll get your chance, you'll get your goal, but we don't concede anything. If you're constantly asking your players to run for 95 minutes, and this is the second season in a row that they've been asked to do this, and this kind of older squad with Fernando Reyes at the heart of it, and he's been missing a lot of this second half of the season. It's a big part of why they've failed, I think, to get more wins. If you're asking Ivan Rakitic, who's an excellent player, but if you're asking them to do that for two seasons in a row, and they're dealing with a lot of injuries, and it's all sort of a group of more or less aging players from the sort of 25 to 35, yeah, it's going to take its toll. And I think that the sort of mental and physical exhaustion of that has been a part of why Sevilla have dropped off this season. And I think Julen Lopetegui, in particular, the way that he manages, it's so intense. He rivals Diego Simeone for action on the touchline in terms of the way he's sort of screaming and shouting instructions. And yeah, I think there's been a point where they've hit the wall. And when you hit the wall, it's the mental exhaustion, I think, that comes first. It's the inability to create. And Papu Gomez is, again, another aging player. He's been missing, and that's been a part of that. But I think for me, and I don't want to criticize Monchi too much, because as I said, he's a genius. He's been a large part of what's got Sevilla to this stage in their sort of history. But I think they could have maybe seen this coming a little bit. And curiously enough, the one position they did decide to sort of trust to sort of younger profiles that need a bit of development, Rafa Mir and Youssef En-Nesyri, 23, 24 years old, up front, that's the one position they could have done with a more rounded player and a more complete player. So, yeah, for me, I think Sevilla, we can't be too critical of them, but it does almost feel like if they'd just tweaked some things, if they'd managed to sort of confect their squad a little bit better for me, then they could have been on the verge of something really, really special.
Towards the bottom of the table, it feels as if we have been running at a fairly consistent rate of a sacking every two episodes this season. And unfortunately, that curse has reached the island of Mallorca this time, as Luis Garcia Plaja is gone. He got them the highest ever points total last season in Segunda, but after slipping into the relegation zone, Mallorca decided to replace him with veteran firefighter Javier Aguirre. How does that affect their hopes of staying up, in your opinion?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I first of all, I want to say Luis García Plaza gone 6 straight defeats, 4 of those without scoring, which I think is perhaps what maybe did for his job in the end, because I think when you're not scoring and you can't see the reaction from the team on the pitch, even when they go behind, that perhaps was part of what made the Mallorca sort of hierarchy decide to get rid of him. One thing I do find incredible about Luis García Plaza is the fact that he seems to get on well with absolutely everyone in Spanish football. I think it's almost part of the reason that he keeps getting jobs is because so many people speak about how intelligent he is and how well he manages. All the players seem to get on well with him. Salva Sevilla, the club captain, tweeted out his support for him after the sacking, and the fans were waiting outside for him after his sort of final press conference. There was tears in his final press conference. The fact that he seems to be this such a lovable character seems to really help him in getting jobs. He's already been rumoured to be sort of the leading candidate for Levante next season if they do go down. So, credit to him for just being a nice guy, which apart from his obvious managerial ability, helps him. And they brought in another different character in Javier Aguirre. but he's also quite a nice guy. He's a veteran. He has something of a reputation in Spain for being quite foul-mouthed. He's sort of this old, I don't want to say cowboy, but like this old Mexican guy who has no sort of qualms about about no sort of mincing of his words. He's fun. He gives a lot of good quotes in press conferences, and everyone kind of just enjoys his presence there. And he'll look at things differently to Luis García Plaza. Luis García is a very sort of offensive-minded manager. You can see that in the way that their squad is built. You can see the fact that Take Kubo and Lee Kang-jin, are both in that squad. Very creative players, almost tens, very sort of tricky, small, technical attackers. He was looking at a sort of more free-flowing Mallorca. Javier Aguirre will be back to basics in a sense. He will be looking to make this team as solid as possible. He'll be looking to make sure they're organized. He'll be hoping to make them a threat on the counter-attack. And you could see that against Getafe at the weekend where, okay, things went wrong. They lost 1-0, but I think they were a little bit unfortunate. There's a handball decision in there. It ends up leading to a second yellow for their defender. Once they go down to 10 men, Getafe really start to push on and eventually kind of make that breakthrough. But yeah, he'll look to do things a little bit differently. I think when you've got sort of 8 games to go, it can be useful to have that sort of presence of somebody who sort of organizes you and makes sure you're just hard to beat. And then you ride your luck to a certain extent. You trust your players to get you over the line with a goal. I think almost more than anything, it's the domineering personality of Javier Aguirre that could keep them up. He just takes everything in his stride. And as I say, he's such a jovial character to have around as well. Like he's so fun to have sort of in the press, and I assume that's what it's like for the players as well. The fact that you have this sort of guy who's not worried about anything. He's there sort of having a good time, enjoying his work. He's serious as well, and yeah, he will cuss his players out and make no doubt about that. But the fact that his sort of personality is there has got to be a calming presence for Mallorca. On the one hand, I look at is that very smart and that it makes them a little bit more defensively solid. They've got a bit more sort of steel in them for this kind of closing stage of games. On the other hand, I wonder if it's maybe too different a style and maybe too much of a change with sort of 7-8 games to go for the Aguirre to implement. And so, I think if you want to bring in sort of a motivational coach for the last 8 games, Aguirre is not a bad shout. If it works, I think they've got a decent shot.
Yeah, he seems a truly likeable guy. I think I remember him from the sidelines on the World Cup as well. On Monday evening, Alaves put out a comunicado oficial. Excuse my pronunciation. It was indeed another sacking after getting rid of Javi Calleja at the end of December. José Luis Mendilibar has won just one of the 12 games he was in charge of. And Alaves have since sunk to the bottom of the table for the first time this season. Why exactly didn't it work? And again, is there any hope for them?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to tread over sort of already trodden on ground, which is not a phrase and shows that we are recording this in the morning and not the evening as usual when my brain is working better. But I think it was a silly choice to sack Javi Calleja. At the time I said so, and I didn't think Mendilibar was necessarily the right choice. And that's, again, and I said that at the time, that Mendy is somebody that I love. I think he's a great coach. He's a great manager. He's got a place in the hearts of many La Liga fans. But what Calleja had done very well before he was sacked is kind of balance the ambition of this side. He gave them enough sort of ambition and belief in themselves to go forward at times with the capabilities of the side, because frankly, I think where Alaves are falling down more than any faults in their managers is that they just don't have the quality. If you look at their squad compared to others, I think maybe Cadiz can rival them for sort of a lack of quality in their squad. But yeah, Alaves are one of the worst teams on paper. And so you need sort of something extra in your management there. And I think Mendy, for as good a manager as he is, he's much more idiosyncratic. He has a set style that he wants to work with. He wants to push up and he wants to have sort of a mid to high line. He wants to get down the wings quickly and cross it in, which in theory can work with Alaves. But it's I think once you try and push up, you need to be so well organized and you need to be so sort of spot on with your pressing to make sure it all works. And if you aren't quite as spot on, if you say bring in that manager in the middle of the season instead of at the start of the season, and he doesn't maybe have time to sort of get across his methods immediately. Yeah, I think there was evidence that this perhaps wasn't a good appointment. I think Alaves, to a certain extent, it seems like their board has checked out a little bit on this team. And I think you're starting to see that Alaves themselves, the players perhaps, I think Hossaloo, who's their star striker and a large part of what's kept them up in recent years, is perhaps on his way to Espanyol at the end of the season on a free. If you don't get sort of the goals from him, they're not really coming from anywhere else. And so I think there's maybe just a few too many different problems for Mendilibar to solve. I'm sad for Mendilibar. I'm not sure I would have taken this job if I was him. I think Alaves, they kind of made their bed at the start of the season to a certain extent, and they haven't improved their lot since they sat Calleja. And in 12 games, yeah, one win, four draws and seven defeats. It just isn't enough. They sunk to the bottom of the table for the first time after this weekend. And it looks, Abelardo is kind of an old manager at Alaves, and Asier Garitano, another sort of former manager, good motivators, good organisers. They were rumoured to be coming in. There's also sort of Velasquez who has been touted by Karina Serra. And they've got a decent enough fixture list, so I don't want to rule them out. But right now, I would back sort of the three, four teams around them who they all have to play, who Alaves have to play still. I'd back them to beat Alaves at the minute. So they've got an uphill task, I'll say that. Moving on to Italy. Sunday night saw Juventus lose 1-0 to an Inter Milan side, which produced a defensive display of which their cheering counterparts would no doubt have been proud. Juve's focus will now turn back to securing a place in the top four, having fallen out of the title picture and crashed out of the Champions League against Villarreal. Jose Mourinho's AS Roma are, of course, hot on their heels in the battle for a spot in the top four. There's no doubt that Massimiliano Allegri's Juve side are able to bounce back from setbacks, but why are they struggling so much to maintain momentum this season, Michael?
It's maybe been one of the most intriguing stories in Serie A this season. Of course, we spoke a lot about Juventus at the start after they made a disastrous start when Massimiliano Allegri returned. And I initially had them as favourites to win the league with him coming back. And I still think that they possess one of the strongest squads in Italy. And I think in January, that they bolstered it as well. But yeah, this was such a weird display in terms of how the game panned out against Inter Milan. I mean, usually in these types of games, especially the Inter Milan we've come to know under Simone Inzaghi, they're a breath of fresh air in terms of their sort of attacking verve and patterns of play. And it was very much a role reversal in the sense that I think Juventus had four times as many shots as Inter Milan, four times as many shots on target. And Inter Milan's only goal came from a penalty which was retaken in some of the most controversial circumstances that you will see, in that there was an encroachment for the initial penalty. The initial penalty itself was soft, I think, in fairness to the referee, Massimiliano Irrati, which is a great name for sort of, I'm not going to say it too clearly, but for crazy refereeing decisions. But I do think he actually got both decisions marginally right, but they were tight calls. And so Hakim Çalhanoğlu stepped up to take the first penalty, which is saved, and then goes the same way on the second penalty when it's retaken due to Matthijs de Ligt who encroached and then got the subsequent block in. Yeah, ultimately it was a smash and grab from Inter Milan. And I think that in many ways, you know, we look to see some of the problems with Juventus, but there has been a lot of good work under Massimiliano Allegri. And I think that shouldn't be sort of understated during the season. And this was their first defeat in the league since November, the first defeat in 2022 in the league. But of course, the problems were on show during that really quite humiliating defeat for them against Villarreal, where although we know how good Unai Emery is in Europe, you know, we know how It was still probably the most one of the most favourable ties Juventus could have got at that stage in the competition, and being the last Italian representation in the cup, I think, just added more to it, especially when we've been talking about Italian football in the past few weeks, and now with Italy not making the Euros as well. But I think in terms of sort of tactically and stylistically, what kind of went wrong against Inter is that for all the chances that Juventus had, and yes, they had four times as many shots, and yes, they did, they probably were the better team on the night. I don't think there's any taken away from that. There was nowhere near enough variation in terms of their attacking play. And even though Allegri's got this Juventus side very organised, very motivated, there's still nowhere near enough variation in my eyes. And in the sense that Allegri, and like his sort of earlier days, and what I was hoping when Dusan Vlahovic first arrived in January, when it looked like he might go back to his old 4-3-1-2, seemed very set on wanting to deploy this 4-2-3-1 with Dybala behind Vlahovic and then Alvaro Morata as one of the wide players and Juan Cuadrado as the other. And I think that immediately screams to you that these are two players who are not, okay, Cuadrado is quite a natural winger, but he's in the latter stages of his career. And Alvaro Morata, as good a player as he can do a job anywhere on the pitch, really, where you want to use him, he's kind of, you know, a utility player, is very harsh on him, but he has played that role for numerous managers, numerous teams over the past few years. He's not what you're going to get in terms of that creativity from wide positions. And I think that was really obvious in the sense that almost all of Juventus's attacks through the game were either coming from individual moments or from Juan Cuadrado on the right-hand side, pumping good deliveries again into the box. But it did allow Inter Milan to just sort of reset every time and really plan how to deal with them. And, you know, the volume of chances Juventus, or volume of momentum and the sort of winning other areas of the pitch and more defensive areas, meant that they were recycling the play and having a lot of chances. But there just wasn't enough variation. And I think Allegri will be thinking, you know, come into next season, although it's a long way away, when Federico Chiesa comes back, that's going to be a big boost for them. But I just think the sort of decisions to see the likes of Dejan Kulusevski, who we've seen do absolutely brilliantly in his time at Tottenham so far, and we saw him do brilliant in Italy when he was at Parma, that's just looking like a more mind-boggling decision by the day if Allegri's so determined on using wingers, with the only other option in the squad at the moment, Bernardeschi, who's flattered to deceive since arriving, really. So I think in terms of where I think Juventus have to go from here, and I'm sure Allegri will be thinking that they need more variation in terms of their attacking players, but also so they can deploy more systems and maybe, or just deploy this one system that he wants to use even better, because he seems very set on a 4-2-3-1. But with all that, I would say there's a pinch of salt. I would say that Juventus are doing a lot of good work. I guess my final note would be I'm kind of torn over what's been happening in a wider context in Italian football, Juventus' exit in Europe, with Italy's exit from the World Cup qualifiers, whether that may be the catalyst for a rebuild in the summer. But we'll have to wait and see, because Giorgio Chiellini was probably the second best player on the pitch, and he's been one of the best players when he's featured this season. So in terms of a rebuilding job, I think there's a lot of questions to be asked as to actually who needs moving on and not just reducing it to the simple matter of age.
Interesting. Yeah, Juventus perhaps contributing to Italian football's existential crisis. One team who do seem to be benefiting from their European exit are Napoli. Luciano Spalletti's side recorded their fourth victory in five after defeating Atalanta 3-1 at the weekend. With just seven games to go, they sit second in the table with none of the top four left to face. So, Michael, what are the main factors that could see the Gliazzurri become Scudetto winners?
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to a similar theme we've discussed quite a bit with Napoli this season, which ultimately is that their strength in depth. And I've been very critical of it for a lot of the season. I think Napoli, in fact, have one of the strongest starting 11s in Italy. And with Luciano Spalletti, have maybe the best fit manager for playing personnel. But one of the downfalls has often been strength in depth. And when we saw players injured before AFCON, during AFCON this year, it was, you know, Napoli did look like they'd actually fallen away from the title race. And now they find themselves second, a point behind AC Milan with this inferior head-to-head record. But with seven games to go, their next two games are quite difficult, but they will fancy themselves. I think they've got a much better run than AC Milan. And I think it's only Inter Milan who maybe have a marginally better running going in, especially now they've got this Juventus game out of the way that we just discussed. But what was one of the really sort of satisfying things about this Napoli side in their victory against Atalanta was that we didn't see Victor Osimhen. We didn't see Di Lorenzo, who's been their most featured outfield player and was key when Italy won the Euros in the summer. And instead, we saw some players from the fringes who really started shining at the sort of at each end of the career. I mean, we talked about the Roma fullback a few weeks ago, and this time it was a 10, and we've been talking about Italy looking to rebuild. And Alessandro Zanoli, who came in at right back for Di Lorenzo, I just thought was absolutely fantastic. He led the way for touches in the game. He led the way for completed passes. He led the way for carries, and he led the way for successful dribbles as well from right back, and played a part in setting up one of the goals as well. It was an outstanding performance from him. And one of the issues that Napoli have had when Osimhen's been missing for most of the season is that Andrea Petagna, known as the Bull in Italy, very much for his sort of lack of mobility, very stiff striker, and he's just a bit of a brute in the box, essentially. And it doesn't really fit with, I don't think he's ever really been that fit, much of a fit for Napoli since arriving from Spal 2 seasons ago. But what we did actually see the return of in this game, and who we saw play a more prominent role than we've seen for a couple of years in the Napoli shirt, was Dries Mertens, which was really refreshing. Now, Dries Mertens, by the end of the season, is going to be 35 years of age, and is, you know, his best days are far gone from him. But seeing him given that centre-forwards role in Osimhen's absence, he completed 87 minutes of the game, which is the first time he's completed more than 75 minutes in a Napoli win since the start of 2022 in a narrow win versus Sampdoria, where he was playing a very different role. But again, although he didn't get on the score sheet, Mertens, he was at the heart of the win. He was sort of, his runs were so clever when Napoli were playing on the counter-attack, when and I just thought there was, and it played a big part in the third player who's sort of coming from the fringes, Elif Elmas, who scored the winning goal. And it was his run, Mertens, which created the space for Elmas to have a really simple finish by past Juan Musso. And yeah, Napoli ultimately were really clinical. We saw Lorenzo Insigne get a goal and assist in not his, albeit the goal was from the penalty spot, not in his most fruitful season. But you just get this feeling with the likes of Insigne and Mertens starting to pop up now for Napoli, two iconic Napoli players in, you know, what we get into the sort of final stages of these legends' careers for the club in what's been quite an difficult period for the club in the past 2 years. You just get, I'm just starting to have this feeling, is this the last dance for Napoli, even though they haven't had all that prior success? But there is really that feeling that something special could be achieved here. And Luciano Spalletti sort of been not so diplomatic in what he said post-game and stuff, but he's really built, feeding into the mentality of that this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Napoli. And it is maybe just going to have to take some of these out-of-skin performances from the likes of Mertens, dragging out all that he's got left. Same for Insigne, and then the likes of these Alessandro Zanoli, who came in to put in these sort of sensational displays that they, you know, young players breaking through to a team can only dream of.
Sounds like a thrilling conclusion to the Scudetto race on its way. Arguably the best performance of the weekend came from Udinese, who battered Cagliari 5-1, with 22-year-old Portuguese striker grabbing the match ball. For a team whose record of finding young gems is hard to rival across the continent, just how highly do you rate the forward who scored 11 goals in his debut Serie A season?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one with Betu. For a few reasons, firstly, I mean, this is really a guy, this is really a guy who's come from absolute nowhere. Now, I'm sure the people, you know, saying if he's ended up at Udinese, that's not the case. But he's a guy who, you know, a lot of the young Portuguese players you'll see spend a year or two at, you know, one of the bigger Portuguese clubs' academies, which Betu did, albeit when he was about 13 or 14. And he spent one season at Benfica. But then other than that, he spent the bulk of his youth career at a club called União Tires, which is based in the Lisbon District League, which is way down the Portuguese footballing ladder. And it was He in fact spent three seasons there until he was 20, and it's only in the last 2 or 3 years he's been able to make the breakthrough into Portimonense, where he had quite a productive 2020-21 season, which led to Udinese getting him on loan with an obligation to buy. But in terms of his return this season, for the young striker to get 11 goals so far has been such a coup for him. And he kind of has all the characteristics of a player who could really go on. I mean, he's 6'4". He's quite powerful. He's fast. He's not rapid. He's not sort of like, you're not talking about a tall Erling Haaland type striker with that kind of explosive speed, but he's definitely not what we describe as an Andrea Petagna ball-like stiff characteristics either. He can certainly get around. His movement in the box is really good. He's, you know, you looked at his goals for Udinese against Cagliari. I mean, Udinese loved playing Cagliari. I think that's fair to say this season also. I think their aggregate score is about 9-1 against them in the league this season, which against any other team, it's not really that matched. But yeah, he's a really interesting striker. I mean, he's been compared to Romelu Lukaku in terms of the way he plays. Initially, I think he's got a Guinea-Bissau heritage, so that he may be looking to play there internationally, but could play for Portugal. There's been rumours that he could be in Santos's plans for the summer now that they've secured qualification for the World Cup later this year. But I do think there is also, you know, again, we just need to be mindful, as we always are with these young players. I mean, what I should say is, although Betis had a great return goal scoring wise this season, he'd also gone by far his longest period without a goal. And, you know, we discussed Lautaro and Martinez this season. You know, that seems to be a common trend with strikers in Serie A. So maybe he's just sort of getting to grips with the goal scoring culture here. And then to come back with a hat-trick, just as Martinez did earlier in the season. But no, overall, I'd say, given where he's come from and the impact that he's had in the season has been really good. Yeah, there's a lot of areas that he can improve. I think his build-up play leaves a bit to be desired, and also maybe just his ability to sort of play in teams where they've got to sort of break down opponents a bit more. Against low blocks, I think you probably want to see a little bit more from him, but he does have the physical attributes as well as the intelligence to pick up space in the box, especially when his team's on the counter-attack, and that's something which could bode really well for him. He's been linked to the likes of Newcastle United. I'd say he's definitely not ready for such a move as of yet. I think you need to see him for another year or two, maybe Udinese, but they've got such a good track record. We've sort of talked about loads of players who've come from there before. Alexis Sanchez is maybe the most standout of them all. And whether he's kind of going to be one of them, I don't know. But it's an exciting time for Udinese. They've got some really good young players at the moment with Nahuelo Molina, Argentinian international, also scored a great goal in the game against Cagliari as well. But yeah, really exciting times for Udinese, especially Beto if he can keep up this fine end to the season.
Interesting stuff, Michael. We're going to take a long break now, and I'll throw it back to Michael and Ali. And yeah, you can have your sort of comfort blanket back in Senor Madden, but I will leave you. But yeah, thank you very much. And yeah, I'll speak to you soon, Michael.
In Germany, Hertha Berlin's recent decision to appoint Felix Magath as their new manager felt decidedly desperate. Winless in 2022, prior to the 68-year-old's arrival at the Olympiastadion, the side from the German capital found themselves in the automatic relegation places at the end of match day 26. With Hertha in real danger of losing their top flight status for the first time in a decade, there was a feeling that Magath's appointment would perhaps be nothing more than yet another nail in the club's proverbial coffin. And yet, the first fixture of the Magath era provided cause for relative optimism, with the old lady registering a convincing 3-0 win over Sebastian Hoeneß's in-form Hoffenheim side. So, with 6 huge games left between now and the end of the season, how confident are you that Magath and his beleaguered Hertha Berlin side can avoid the drop?
Yeah, Michael, I think that this is the sort of appointment which almost certainly wouldn't work out in the long term. In other words, I don't think we'll see a Felix Magath project spanning a few seasons. However, for some reason, I don't think we can fully rule out the possibility that in the short term, Magath's appointment might be successful and that he might somehow be able to mastermind a relatively great escape. I found it quite interesting, Michael, when Hertha's sporting director, Freddie Bobic, said that Felix Magath's CV speaks for itself, and I say that as a quote. Let's just dissect that CV. In his early days, he oversaw Nuremberg's evolution from a side expected to slip to the third division of German football into one which would ultimately earn promotion to the top flight. After that, he played an important role in steering Werder Bremen clear of relegation trouble. He then ensured that Eintracht Frankfurt maintained their top flight status at the end of what had been a bumpy 1999-2000 Bundesliga campaign for the Eagles. Magath had come in about halfway through the season when the club were second from bottom in the table. He thereafter worked similar magic at Stuttgart, replacing none other than Ralf Rangnick with 12 games to play of the 2000-2001 season. Again, when he took over, Stuttgart were second from bottom. There's a bit of a pattern emerging here. But he guided them to the safety of a 15th placed finish. At the other end of the table, he became the first coach in Bundesliga history to win back-to-back league and DFB Cup doubles, doing so in 2005 and 2006 while in charge at Bayern Munich. He then won the Bundesliga title with that iconic Wolfsburg side in 2008-2009, working as both the club's sporting director and head coach. You might remember the front two there at Wolfsburg was Grafite and Edin Dzeko, a very young Edin Dzeko, but a very prolific Edin Dzeko at that. He then almost guided Schalke, who of course have fallen on hard times of late. He almost guided Schalke to the Bundesliga title in 2009-2010 before returning to Wolfsburg to rescue their season. They sat second bottom. Again, the pattern continues when he took over in March 2011, but Magath once again worked wonders and Wolfsburg ultimately secured their safety on the final day of the season with a huge 3-1 win away at Hoffenheim. So I can see why Freddie Bobic was perhaps inclined to say that Magath's CV speaks for itself. However, I do think we have to emphasise the fact that Magath's reputation as a winner of titles and as a fighter of fires at the other end of the table was forged more than a decade ago. Looking at the CV to which Bobic so glowingly refers, there is also a quite notable gap. He hadn't had a coaching role in over 4 years until Hertha came along, and he hasn't worked in the top five leagues since leaving Fulham in September 2014. Now, Michael, it's nowhere near the levels of Raymond Domenech taking over at Nantes in December 2020. That was a whole different level of craziness altogether. But that lack of recent coaching experience at an elite level, anyway, still represents food for thought, Michael. As a coach, Magath is, of course, a renowned disciplinarian, and his training sessions are notoriously brutal. Some of his alleged methods are eyebrow-raising, to say the least. And the story goes that when he was at Fulham, he told Brede Hangeland, that Norwegian cult hero, to treat a knee injury with a block of cheese from Tesco. He said, get some cheese on it, get some alcohol on that, and yeah, it'll all be fine. Now, the Magath camp has obviously rubbished those claims, but nevertheless, you do wonder quite what Magath's methods may well be. Part of me does think that Hertha have indirectly benefited from Magath's eccentricity. Because Magath is so eccentric, because Magath is so enigmatic, the focus was temporarily shifted away from Hertha's poor squad and onto the 68-year-old and onto his coaching methods, onto his CV, to which Bobic, of course, so glowingly refers. That probably played at least a partial role as Hertha registered that vital 3-0 win over Hoffenheim at the Olympiastadion on match day 27. Now, you could almost write the script. Felix Magath actually had COVID, so he was confined to a hotel room while the game took place. And in his absence, this is where it gets really quite interesting. His Scottish assistant, Mark Fotheringham, took charge. Now, Fotheringham was actually being linked, believe it or not, with the Dunfermline job just before Christmas, and he served as the assistant manager at Cowdenbeath for about a year and a half between 2017 and 19. The Olympia Stadion is a far cry from East End Park and Central Park, the cowed and beef version of Central Park, not the one in New York, I should add. But Fotheringham did not look out of place at all in the German capital. His energy and his dynamic personality played a key role in enabling Hertha to produce the type of performance they will need to replicate between now and the end of the season, should they wish to preserve their Bundesliga status. On the weekend just there, they lost 2-1 away at Leverkusen. They've got some huge games coming up. They currently find themselves in 17th, second from bottom, the position from which Magath has previously worked wonders for various clubs, including the likes of Eintracht Frankfurt and Wolfsburg. So perhaps that pattern will continue here at the Olympiastadion. It will be interesting to see what happens. I think, if I'm honest, I would quite like to see Hertha stay in the division. I think they're a really interesting club. They're a really interesting case study. They've got the derby coming up against Union soon. I believe Rudy Barlow is going to try and get tickets for that one. So we'll no doubt hear about that. Every game between now and the end of the season is massive for them. It's massive for Magath. And you do wonder if he can keep them up. Will he maybe resurrect his managerial career? Because of late, anyway, and particularly post-Fulham, his reputation hasn't been too great. Let's see how they'll fare until the end of the season. Okay, that brings to an end another episode of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. Hopefully you found it enlightening. I would say thank you to Michael Jones. I'll say thank you to Rudy Barlow in his absence. And I'll say thank you to you, the listener. Hopefully you're staying safe. Hopefully you're staying well. Until next time, goodbye.